This panel, entitled International Content Control on the Global Net, is about just what it sounds like. We have three distinguished panelists who I'll introduce in a moment. My name is Danny Weitzner from the Center for Democracy and Technology, and I'll be moderating this panel. The reason for this panel at this conference is that it seemed to all of us on the program committee that this is really the year that governments all around the world, including the United States, Singapore, China, Germany, and others, discovered the Internet. We've all known about it for a while, but a number of governments have discovered the net, and in various ways they've discovered that it may be a little bit too democratic, a little bit too sexy, a little bit too anti-authoritarian, and they've certainly discovered that it's awfully hard to control in any way. We have three panelists who I'll introduce to discuss issues regarding international content control on the global Internet. Beginning on my right, we have Dr. Herbert Birkett. Dr. Birkett is advisor on information law and information policy to the German National Research Center for Information Technology. He is also chairman of the Legal Advisory Board for the European Commission, General Directorate 13, DG 13 is responsible for telecommunications policy in the European Union. He's also a member of the Cologne Bar. Next we have Kate Martin, who is director of the Center for National Security Studies in Washington. She is here in particular because she and her organization are involved in a project on civil liberties and national security law reform in Eastern European countries. She has been traveling extensively in Eastern European countries dealing with national security issues and civil liberties issues, and I think we'll have a lot to report on. At the end of the table, we have Gara LaMarche, Associate Director of Human Rights Watch. Gara is also Director of Human Rights Watch's Free Expression Project and the Chair this year of the International Free Expression Exchange. And I'm happy that everyone could come from everywhere, from where they came. I'm going to ask each of the panelists to make about a 15-minute statement, and we'll then throw it open to questions. So, Dr. Birkett, please.
Thanks very much. I think I want to pick up on your statement. This seems to be the year of discovery of the Internet by national governments. I think it is also the year of cultural convergence, if you like to use the word cultural in this context, toward contents control. So if you look at Europe and if you wait for Lafayette coming over here to help you to sort out a few problems, I'm afraid you will wait in vain. Rather, we are waiting for George Washington crossing the Delaware, I don't know. Two trends I think are visible in Europe. One is the what I would call the visible fist approach. And the other approach is what I would call the invisible feet approach. What do I mean by the visible fist approach? Let me start with a quote from an interview with a European Minister of Justice on the possibility to regulate certain things on the net. Quote, "Even if I wanted to prohibit it, I could not effectively prohibit it. The government is entering a race it cannot win. But of course we must try it. Those who think one can stop it will in the end have to give it up. Any national attempt will fall short of its aim. Therefore we have to have international agreements." Now this is a translation into English. Now I will try to translate it into logic. I think what this gentleman was saying is that we cannot do anything about it, but we must be seen to do something about it, and we must be seen internationally to do something about it. Now, this of course poses a problem. It poses a problem both to the regulator and both to those who are on the other side of the regulatory game. First of all, the problem to the regulator is that in terms of technology and resources, the regulator cannot do very much about contents control, at least not in terms of, let us say, technological control or technical control. I also suspect that they do not really want to do much about you see, these at least some of the regulators have realized that there is a connection between economic activities that will prosper with the internet, and there's a relationship with jobs, and they all want to attract these industries, they want to have these jobs. And they do not want to break up this relationship. They want to have these industries in their country. But of course, there are people, and I think the way the internet has been covered in the media has contributed to that a lot. There are people who think that there is a privileged bunch enjoying something that they should not be enjoying, whether it's enjoyable or not. And that government shows itself to be absolutely impotent if it doesn't do anything about it. So this has to be addressed. And this is why, you know, this sort of statement comes about that I've been reading too. So what is actually happening is some sort of government regulatory doublespeak. They try to address at the same time the initiated and what they see as to be the ordinary people. To the initiated, they say, well, don't really worry. We understand the problem. We are not that technically stupid. We know that it's very difficult to put a grip on technologically. And to the less initiated, or what they see it to be as the less initiated, to the ordinary man, they say, ah, we do something. We do something. Don't worry. And I call this the visible fist, because actually, what governments rely on is the invisible hand of the market, of course. And the question is, if the invisible hand of the market does so many things, what do we know? What do we need the visible hand of the government for still? You know? So the visible hand of the government, with a few fingers that are still left after privatization, or after, you know, shaking hands in private public partnerships, with a few fingers that are left at the visible hand of the government, they are making that fist and waving it and say, well, we will address that. Now, I think, though, we should be very careful, because there are effective ways to control things with very little resources. I'm afraid we in our country have a bad tradition about that. And one effective way is, for instance, to make every citizen a policeman on each other citizen. You do not need much of a technology to do that. If you make a regulation saying that everybody, you know, who turns in somebody else who has been reading material that he or she should not have been reading gets his or her computer impounded, and maybe a computer goes to the informer. So maybe that Macintosh owners at that time are in a safe position. Who wants to own a Macintosh today? But what I want to say with this is that you should not have a tunnel view on the technology. There are social instruments, social control instruments. You can appeal to dark instincts. And this can turn out to be very effective. Of course, you get a different society in the end, and whether this society can really function very well in today's economic environment, this is another question. it's also bad law because you have some sort of double law, and there will be some people against whom the law will be less used. It will be more used against others. There occasionally has to be a fall guy to show that this is not just symbolic law, but you know something is happening. Now, so much about the visible fist approach. The invisible feet approach is that feeling, you know, that you have when you go out with your girlfriend for dinner and you were with other friends, and at the time you look under the table and you see your friend's feet and your girlfriend's feet, and at a later stage you look under the table again and you see these feet have moved and have somewhat converged. Now, this may be perhaps not politically correct, but it's certainly something that sentimentally gets at your heart. What I want to say about it, what I want to say with that is that there is a movement of convergence happening certainly on the European Union level. And within the European Union bodies, there is a deliberation whether one should whether one should regard the new services and what is happening on the internet as telecommunications or as mass communications, mass communications, and or whether one should think up something totally new. I'm afraid is what might happen. What the danger is, what might happen is that you take all the control elements of telecommunications and all the control elements of mass communications and bring them together and try to make them applicable. But this is still an open game. If you regard the new services as telecommunications, competition law would take care of everything. That would be more or less the general approach, with an ingredient of universal service, perhaps even universal service of content. If you regard it as mass communications, then of course a lot of elements of control come in. There is a control of ownership, not only in the economic sense, but also with regard to the impact on public opinion. Mass communication is the instrument with which you get or lose voters. And this is why mass communication has always been at the center of regulatory deliberations of content. Also in mass communications you have far more controls of on content than you have in telecommunications. You have the problem of response rights. You have the problem of declaring authorship or declaring, making visible ownership. And particularly in the European context, you have, of course, the question of balancing cultural content. Now, I don't know how to handle this. I mean, there must be a certain portion of your website that contains European cultural content. I don't, you know, I just want to show where this is going to. There are deliberations about that. There are deliberations about that in the member states, but the battle has just started. It is not over yet. And I think I stop with that introduction. Happy to answer further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. We may ask you to come back and discuss the CompuServe situation after everyone else has spoken. Kate Martin, Dr. Burkert has talked about the responses, the national responses. What about international law here? In the human rights community, we rely on international law for certain help in certain cases. In international commerce, we rely on international law. The net seems to combine all those issues. How do we think about international law in this context?
Well, I think the thing that's really interesting about international law and the internet is that it raises some brand new, very fundamental, almost philosophical issues about how does international law work. And I thought, I come to this question from the perspective of a civil liberties and human rights activist, that I would just outline a little bit about the way international human rights law works in general in the world and raise some issues about the question of international restrictions on the content on the internet, and just mention also the issue of restrictions on the privacy of communications on the internet. You know, when we talk about the subject and we think about the question of, well, does Germany or Singapore have the right or the capability to ban content on the internet under their national law, and you end up with one set of problems. But there is the whole question of the applicability of international law to these questions. And I think that those of us in the United States, at least traditionally, have not looked to international law as a source of protection for freedom of expression or privacy rights to the degree that activists in the rest of the world do. In fact, international law is much more important in my experience outside the United States in terms of protecting free speech and privacy than it is in the United States. And I thought I'd just outline how that works a little bit, but first mention kind of an overarching issue here, which is, from my perspective, I start out thinking, is international law a source of protection that we can turn to here in combating content restrictions on the internet or in securing the privacy of communications on the internet? My colleague, Mr. Burka, and the governments, I think, of the world think to themselves, can we use international law to set up a legal regime which will, in fact, regulate content in the way we want it regulated? So right there you have this question of, is international law going to be the source of additional restrictions on our rights, or is international law going to be the source of protections for additional rights? And it's actually a very complicated question. Most democracies, and indeed many countries which are not democracies, are in fact parties to international human rights treaties, which obligate them to respect basically basic human rights, including freedom of expression, freedom of movement, and rights of privacy. Probably the most widely subscribed to treaty is the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which the United States recently signed and became a party to. It was first signed and became effective in 1966. In many areas of the world, in Europe, for example, individuals have individual avenues to go to court and to go to an international courts in Europe and claim that their government has violated this international covenant on for the protection of human rights with regard to the actions that it's taken against the individual. It's a lengthy, cumbersome process, and you don't just get to go file the way you do in the United States and go walk down to federal court, but the mechanism is available. There's a similar treaty that protects human rights in the Americas, and a similar mechanism for going to basically an international court that will decide whether or not the provisions of the human rights treaties were complied with, and which the governments, the judgments of the courts, the governments are then obliged to respect. In the United States, we have, in some ways, we have fewer procedural protections to rely directly on the provisions of the international covenant. The international covenant in the U.S. is what's called a non-self-executing treaty, and you don't have the right to go directly to federal court and file a lawsuit saying that the Exxon Amendment violates the international covenant on protection for freedom of expression. The reason for this, however, is supposed to be that the Constitution itself provides at least the same and perhaps more protection for freedom of expression and the right to privacy than does the international covenant. Whether or not it does in any particular situation is not always clear. I think there's at least some situations where the international covenant arguably provides greater protection for human rights. But in many instances, the First Amendment is in fact more protective. So there are a couple of substantive things to know about international human rights law, which is not my field of expertise in all honesty, and is very complicated. But one is that it does provide a basic floor for the protection of free expression. Article 19 of the International Covenant says that freedom of expression and the freedom to hold opinion shall be protected. However, unlike the First Amendment, it explicitly contains exceptions to those rights and says, for example, except where national security, public order, or public health require the abridgment of freedom of expression. And there are two areas in the whole content field that have been a source of a lot of writing, a lot of cases, and are basically unresolved. And they are the areas referred to by Mr. Burka, having to do with hate speech and having to do with what you could call seditious speech or advocacy of unlawful action. As many of you, I'm sure, know, Nazi speech is outlawed in Germany. It is explicitly protected. It has been held by the Supreme Court to be protected by the First Amendment in this country. We have a very protective standard on advocacy of violence. The First Amendment protects your right to talk about or advocate political violence to achieve a political end. That question is obviously a lot more difficult question for a country like Israel. And a lot of countries that subscribe to the International Covenant also prohibit advocacy of violence, of political violence, in situations that we would call it unconstitutional restriction. So that's where you kind of come up against the question of how do you have an international regime that's going to, on the one hand, from the governmental perspective, restrict content on the internet. And I think that's the issue that the German minister refers to when he says they would like to, but how are they going to, because which standard are you going to accept when different countries have different laws about what can be restricted on the basis of content and others don't. And from our perspective, I think it raises the question of how do we use international law to protect the internet? And can we and will we be successful in using international law to protect the internet? And indeed, then the question I think is going to arise quite quickly about what is the, does it make sense to try to develop international standards on these questions? And I don't know the answer to that question. I think there are some things which are in a way obvious, but which don't answer the question, which is, you know, at the moment you can argue in a way that the national law that's most protective of free speech ought to be the standard for international restrictions, because otherwise you're going to run into all of these problems that you referred to. In the case of freedom of expression, I think most international law scholars would agree that the First Amendment is in general more protective of freedom of expression than most international law. And that, you're then faced with the question of, well, do you want to even look at or work towards any kind of international standard, because aren't you going to end up with something more watered down than we have in the First Amendment? And on the other hand, I think that we're about to be faced with the question of the German government and the United States government and the Russian government talking to each other about developing some kind of international protocol on regulating the Internet. And if that happens, I think the activist community has to be prepared to be there and be heard and in some ways come up with the legal answers to, well, how do we have an international regime given these differing approaches to free expression? I guess I just want to mention another, what I think is a very related problem in a way, although it's not directly on the subject, which is the question of international protection for the privacy of your email communications or otherwise on the Internet. And this, I think, will turn out to be an even thornier problem in international law. And the reason for that is that fundamentally the protections for privacy of communications in the U.S. and in elsewhere have always been based on the assumption that the right of privacy in the U.S. Constitution, for example, protects U.S. citizens' communications and protects those communications whether or not the U.S. citizens are in the United States or abroad, and that the Fourth Amendment right of privacy protects communications inside the United States, whether or not those communications are made by citizens or non-citizens, but that there has never been any privacy protection afforded by the U.S. Constitution to Russians who are in Russia, for example. And so as a consequence, as we all know, governments freely eavesdrop on foreigners' communications abroad. And I think that was, it was never deemed to be a theoretical problem, and I think the reason is because it wasn't much of a practical problem, because the level of international communications between ordinary citizens was much less than what it is today and what it's going to be tomorrow. And I just to raise the problem, I think that we're going to see, to the extent that all of us use the Internet to communicate with our colleagues abroad in Russia or in China or in Singapore, that we are going to see the question of what do the Russian government and the U.S. government do about cooperating with regard to getting access to our communications with our colleagues in those countries. There is not only no legal regime that answers that question at the moment, but it's hard to even, I don't know of a human rights civil liberties organization that's really developed a position on how do you solve that problem, unless you take the position basically that there's going to be no eavesdropping for any reason with any kind of warrant or any kind of probable cause. But I think that question about international restrictions and an international regime that's either protective of the use of the Internet or in fact sanctions interference with the use of the Internet is something that hasn't been resolved, and that it's going to be, it's a difficult but very important thing for all of us to look at.
Thank you, Kate. Gara, if I could just summarize where we are. We know China's requiring people to get licenses for email addresses. Singapore is making various policies on content control. The state of Bavaria in Germany is pushing CompuServe in America Online around, affecting all of us on the global Internet. Dr. Burkert has told us that we're going to be subject either to visible fist or invisible feet, neither of which seem to bode particularly well. And Kate Martin has told us that the application of international law for these problems is uncertain at best. From a practical perspective, from an activist perspective, where do we go from here?
thanks. That's a great. I want to just say that the name in my name in certain parts of the program is listed as Gawa, G-O-W-A. In fact, it's Gara, G-A-R-A. Gawa is kind of something like your kid might say when they're trying to learn to speak and becomes a family nickname. In fact, it might now become a family nickname, but it doesn't happen to be my name, actually. I'm the Associate Director of Human Rights Watch, and Human Rights Watch, for those of you who are not familiar with us, is the largest U.S.-based international human rights monitoring organization. We cover a range of issues, including free expression. But also women's rights and violations of the laws of war and children's rights and abusive use of blinding laser weapons and landmines and a whole host of issues in 70 or more countries around the world. We have been concerned for the last couple of years with the questions that are before us today having to do with the application of the free expression standards to cyberspace. And what I want to do in my time here today is slightly different than what I originally intended to do, but not substantially different, if that's all right. What I asked to do when I talked with Danny a couple of weeks ago about this was not so much to do what my colleagues have just done, which is to lay out some of the problems and some of the legal standards and issues. I wanted actually to talk a little bit more about, and I think you've given me a nice lead into it, about what you can do about it. You know, what kinds of activism are appropriate to the kinds of trends that we're seeing. And I think that what's been going on in the United States in the last couple of years, and particularly in the last couple of months, with respect to the Exxon bill and the Communications Decency Act, provides some guideposts for us when we're talking about dealing with restrictions in our capacity as global citizens. So I see this conference, by the way, as kind of a metaphor, this audience is kind of a metaphor for the Internet. And for that reason, I'm going to keep my remarks very very short. I mean, it's like the Internet in that you can't basically see who you're speaking with. But it's also like the Internet in the sense that all the experts are not, you know, up on the stage. I mean, this is we would be wasting an opportunity for an interchange if we spent too much time talking at you. So let me just say a few things, and then hopefully we can proceed in a short time to a back and forth. Let me talk first about a little bit more global context here. Human Rights Watch has been doing, making preparations to do a report that we plan to release in a variety of forms in the next couple of months, having to do with a roundup of what's going on internationally. A lot of that has been mentioned today, but I think Danny's right when he says that in the last year or so, many governments seem to have discovered the Internet. And all of a sudden, I think an issue that as recently as a year ago was not really on the agenda, even for many human rights organizations, all of a sudden is. There's a lot going on out there. A lot of it has been mentioned. In addition, you have places like Vietnam and Saudi Arabia, which require many countries which are going the model of requiring a single government-controlled gateway for Internet service. You have access issues in many countries, both with respect to exorbitant rates of access, but also, you know, the fundamental problems that we haven't really touched on yet today, and perhaps when you've had other sessions to talk about the United States, this has come up, but the information haves and the information have-nots. That's an issue in the United States, I know, and a lot of debate within this community about the fact that many people don't have access at the moment to the technology we're talking about. If you want to put it on a global level, that's exacerbated even more. 80% of the people in the world don't have basic telephone service or basic telecommunication service. 49 countries in the world have less than one telephone per 100 people, and 35 of those countries are in Africa. So one of the things we found when we did our little global survey that we were about to share with a smaller group and ultimately with a larger group is that the issues we're talking about have risen to the level of governments feeling the need to respond only really in those places, fundamentally in Europe and in Asia, where there's enough access for it to be even a source of concern. Let me talk a little bit about the response of the human rights community to some of these issues. As I said, I think that the human rights movement has been relatively slow to respond for a variety of reasons. Many of them have been slow to grasp and understand and use the technology themselves. This is beginning to change quite significantly in the last year or two, but that was the case. they have been, because of the slowness to respond, I think we haven't really sufficiently seized the initiative to have a presence at many of the global forums and discussions where the question of freedom of expression on the Internet is on the table, or at least ought to be on the table. Danny mentioned that I am the chair, convener at the moment of an international free expression consortium, which is called IFEX, and it represents all the leading free expression organizations in the world, if that doesn't sound too much too bold a claim. Article 19 in London, which is a kind of an Amnesty International for freedom of expression, various journalist rights groups, the Committee to Protect Journalists in the United States, and counterpart organizations like Reporters Sans Frontières in France, Index on Censorship, the magazine in London, in PEN, both internationally and in the United States, the Writers Organization, a variety of other groups. And as recently as a year ago, the issues we're talking about right now, which are really quite basic and fundamental to the future of communications and the future of free expression in the world, really were not on the agenda of most of these groups at all. Human Rights Watch and a number of the other groups represented in this conference took the initiative, I guess it was a year ago, November, when the G7 nations were meeting to discuss the global information infrastructure in Brussels, a follow-up meeting to which is being held, I think, in May in Johannesburg, to try to insert ourselves into those deliberations and to try to put on the table questions of access and questions of freedom of expression. They really weren't there. And that was, in and of itself, very telling. Vice President Gore played a major role in the U.S. position on the conference. The early documents for the conference and ultimately most of the discussions bore no, really didn't have free expression as part of the dialogue. And we were able, I think, through our mighty efforts of a letter that a number of groups signed on to, taking the international free expression standards that Kate mentioned, and recognizing that they're kind of a mixed bag, of course, we tried to interpret those in the most protective way and apply those standards, both the ICCPR and the Universal Declaration and the international standards, and also the relevant national regional conventions, such as the European Convention on Human Rights or the Inter-American, or the American Convention or the African Convention, to cyberspace. And for those mighty efforts of writing a fairly substantive letter and getting a lot of groups to sign on and sending somebody from Human Rights Watch to Brussels to deal with the press and lobby a little bit, I think we got the Vice President to insert a line in his speech which recognized that one of the issues to be concerned about was free expression. So we have a lot of work to do to get our issues on that global agenda as critical decisions are being made for the development of the global information infrastructure. I want to talk basically about the potential for activism here and see what we can, if I can say just a little bit about the way what I see international human rights activism having developed and how that may have some lessons for cyberspace activism. The international human rights movement has been most successful, it seems to me, in mobilizing a mass constituency, to the extent that it's been able to do that, when it has been able to organize around constituencies. In other words, when you're dealing globally, many people, do not really, are pretty much focused on where they are. Very few people think very globally. It's a real challenge for the international human rights movement in this country, for instance, in a country where people very often are very concerned with what's happening to them naturally. And the challenge that we have as an international human rights organization, and most of our colleague organizations do, is how to make Americans feel that they have something in common or some stake in the human rights abuses that are being committed against people in other parts of the world. I mean, that's really the basic challenge. And one of the most successful tools in the human rights movement for doing that in the relatively young life of the human rights movement, which is a post-war movement and really Amnesty International, you know, was founded in 1961 and virtually all of our lifetimes. And Human Rights Watch and a lot of the other groups I'm about to mention are really only 15 or at the most 20 years old. So it's a very young movement. But one of the most successful tools has been to organize people in the United States, or for that matter in other countries, particularly other Western democracies, who feel something in common with their endangered colleagues in some other parts of the world. It's been very much constituency-based. So that, for instance, Penn was the first real model of that. Writers say, or an American writer says, my colleague, the novelist in Uruguay, you know, has been imprisoned, and I want to play my part in getting that person out. The Committee to Protect Journalists does the same thing where journalists are concerned. There's a group here in Boston, the Physicians for Human Rights, which tries to organize the medical community in the same way, by expressing concern with doctors who are themselves and the medical professionals who are themselves in danger, and in many countries doctors for one reason or another are on the front line where human rights abuses are concerned, but also to use the expertise of that community on human rights problems. It's really a dual thing, so that you have, for instance, forensic investigations in which doctors can play a special role. You have more recently, we've organized a Committee for International Academic Freedom at Human Rights Watch, where academics, it's a very large category, you know, both of activists and concerned people, and also a very large category in many countries of those who are subject to human rights abuses, teachers and students, to take up the cases of their endangered colleagues. So that is a model that one might consider. That is to say, that there be created or nurtured or fostered in this country a movement of people who believe themselves to be, to use the term on this button, which I guess may be gaining some currency in this world, netizens. You know, this idea that you identify, it's an interesting term. I mean, it's kind of a cute word, but it suggests something, which is that you are a citizen, not simply of your country, and your loyalties or your identification is not so much with where you happen to live, but with a global community of people united by the net. Now, that's a very powerful force for activism, it seems to me. And it's shown itself to be a powerful force for activism in recent months in the United States with a mobilization on the Communications Decency Act. I take it that this 30,000 figure on the button, which I guess like the McDonald's hamburger sign is growing every day, I understand, are people who have signed something or pledged to oppose the Communications Decency Act. I understand that when the American Civil Liberties Union filed the lawsuit in whenever it was, in January, a couple of months ago, or February, and its website went up virtually the same day, I think, or a day or two after that. I mean, 80,000 people visited that site in the first day and generated an enormous amount of protests and calls to Janet Reno's office. I'm not, you know, telling you anything you don't know, obviously, but I am saying that that enormous potential for activism in the sense of the people in this room, probably, certainly, and many, many more like you out there, is that you are part of a global community. It has enormous potential for solidarity and for activism on behalf of people like yourselves, like ourselves, in other parts of the world that can transcend the national borders problem that often is a problem with human rights activism. Because people, the reason you're active and the reason so many people have signed on against the Communications Decency Act is because they feel personally endangered. A group of journalists, a group of physicians, even a group of writers, novelists, poets, however broadly you want to define it, is always going to be a fairly finite group. Because those people are people who define themselves either professionally, you know, only so many working journalists in the world, or, you know, in terms of their avocation. The group of netizens is very large and is growing all the time. And because of the nature, it seems to me, of cyberspace communications, which by definition make everybody a producer and a communicator and not just a passive recipient of information, unlike virtually every other one of the mass media that we're talking about, where everybody can participate in this system and therefore everybody feels a stake in it. I think that's one of the most exciting things about cyberspace activism is this enormous personal stake that people feel. It's the biggest hurdle for any rights movement is usually to get people to go beyond their immediate interests and have some concern and some care for the rights of other people and see that they're in the same boat with other people. I think that issue, or that problem, or that obstacle, traditionally to activism, is not present. I mean, I'd be interested to hear reactions to it, but maybe I'm naive about it, but it's not present with respect to cyberspace. And therefore, you have an enormous constituency of people who feel that they have something at stake here. Most First Amendment issues, that's not so. But it is the case in cyberspace, and it is the case with respect to restrictions on those kinds of communications. So I see that as an enormous potential that also can be turned in a global direction, it seems to me. So that if you have 30,000 people or 50,000 people or 80,000 people or God knows how many hundreds of thousands or millions of people in the United States who are mobilized in the way that, let's say, artists have been mobilized, you know, over NEA restrictions in recent years. But again, a finite number of people, a much more finite number of people than people who consider themselves to be part of cyberspace. We, I think, in the human rights movement, and those of us in allied movements, need to find a way to turn that in a global direction. And I think there's a lot of exciting potential there, so that what we can do is identify the issues, identify the countries that are trying to restrict speech and expression, humanize those issues as much as possible, make them tangible for people, and try to mobilize some pressure. Because I was struck a little earlier by the point that I think Herbert Burkert made about mass media and the attentiveness of governments to mass media, because that's the media through which people get information and vote. That's the medium that reaches voters. Well, that's true in the United States as well, it seems to me. And I think that one of the reasons why, not to be too much of a Pollyanna about it, but one of the reasons why I think we're doing a lot better with respect to opposition to the Communications Decency Act, and the politicians, in my judgment, are a lot more nervous than one might think, is because they know that there's an enormous constituency out there, and a mobilized constituency, and by definition, particularly because of the access problems for lower-income people that I was speaking about earlier, by definition, an educated and constituency, the kind of people who tend to vote and follow public affairs and act on their beliefs, I think we have an enormous capacity there. So I think actually I went even longer, much longer than I expected to, and I'm just going to stop there. But I'm eager to hear from those of you who are much more a part of this community than I have tended to be, whether you agree that this is a constituency that can be mobilized not only on issues in the United States, but also with respect to what other countries are doing, and try to act in solidarity with our colleagues in other countries who are the subject of restrictive expression policies. Thanks.
Gareth, thank you very much. That's a really helpful perspective. I want to open the floor to questions now, but I want to ask the first question of Dr. Burkert. Tell us a little bit about what happened with CompuServe. People read some press stories. They may not know much more than a couple hundred words about it. Tell us what happened. Tell us the response in Germany, the response in the European community, and where you think that sits in the model that you've proposed and the model that Kate has laid out.
Actually, I no longer know what happened in the CompuServe case. I've read so many different accounts. Some of them even involved sightings of persons of whom we are fairly sure that they are dead since 1945. fairly, yeah. I think the CompuServe case is a classical case of James Cook meeting the Indians. are the railroad builders negotiating with the unions. That is, it is an essay in cultural misunderstanding. From what I understand is that the state attorney's office approached the state attorney's office of Munich, being being the capital of the state Bavaria, approached CompuServe with regard to some material that was accessible on the Usenet groups, and said that making, or alleged to the fact that making this material available is contrary, or seems to be contrary to German criminal law, and that it might be advisable to do something about this in case further procedures would verify the fact that indeed this would be this making this material available would indeed constitute an act against German criminal law. So first of all, it was not the German government, not the federal government. Law enforcement is a matter of the state governments. It was not a court. It was a state attorney. And it was not an order. It was, from what I understand, a communication or a request. And this request, from what I understand, was driven by perhaps a misunderstanding of what news groups are and how they function and what an internet provider does in this context. I have the feeling that the state attorney's office was acting under the impression that this is something you know, as if CompuServe had put this material directly in a mailbox to be picked up by subscribers. This is underlined, my perception is underlined by another perception that after after talking to CompuServe, the state attorney's office seemed to have involved the equivalent of the scientific service of the FBI, that is of our national police office and their scientific researchers, to look and perhaps even give them a briefing on the technical background. So that was after they went to CompuServe. So this seems to underline my perception that this was a misunderstanding of the technology by the state attorney's office, and it was a misunderstanding of the nature of a request from a state attorney's office in the eyes of CompuServe. And maybe they did not want, you know, it is a difficult situation for a foreign company starting a new sort of service. You want to make sure that this service does not get the wrong label when you start it up. But I feel that CompuServe, particularly in view of the reaction that has received, I think not only in the United States, has realized that they have been perhaps too German in their reaction to authority. So what is cooking right now? I think there's not much. A lot of German users were also infuriated about what happened about that. It was not only an American response. What is happening? Well, first of all, it seems to me that CompuServe now has understood the rules of the games a little bit better. I read a press communication some time ago that said roughly about the following, that CompuServe is planning to enlarge its German activities and particularly its Munich office, and that they intend to create some additional 300 jobs, but of course with all the legal uncertainty that still is in the air, they have to postpone this company decision, and this seems to indicate to me that they have now understood the rules of the game. On the other hand, of course, within that framework I was trying to convey in the beginning, the German government is reflecting seriously on what to do about this issue. And unfortunately, there is a precedent, and this is the Computer Decency Act. And they seem to think a lot into this direction. That is, that the responsibility of the information provider goes as far as to provide guarantors, that is, parents, with instruments to effectively or better exercise their rights as parents, and that everything that goes beyond that, in far as access to the internet is concerned, is not their responsibility. But it will be their responsibility that if there is something on news groups they as an organization directly offer or control, and if there's something on these news groups, and if there is strong reason to believe that this is in contravention of a rule, that using the due legal procedures that is going through a court order, they can be asked to put this down. And eventually, if this has been put up through negligence or even with intent, they can be prosecuted. So I think that's also why I said convergence. It's pretty much heading into the direction of the Computer Decency Act now, what's happening in Germany. But the issue has now, I think, no longer that big profile. There's also a lot of controversy among the regulators themselves. You know, some of them think that the laws as they are sufficient. It's only a question of applying them and applying them efficiently. We have a lot of laws that are still laws which are very difficult to enforce, but this still, you know, keeps them as laws, so that should not be the main issue. Some fear that overregulation, you know, would kill the industry, would hurt information services, would eventually also hurt, of course, European information services. So, you know, I think if anything comes up, it will pretty much have the face of the Computer Decency Act.
Which questions?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Which,
Garrett,
by the way, is one of the most regrettable things about the Communication Decency Act, which I don't think has been enough part of the discussion in the United States. I mean, it's a bad thing on its own terms, but if you look at it from a global perspective, and I mean, the United States has traditionally been a beacon for people around the world of greater protection of freedom of speech, and people in their countries who are trying to push their governments toward greater protections for freedom of speech have had the First Amendment in the United States to point to. And the fact that the United States, in taking the lead in regulation of cyberspace, has handed this weapon to repressive governments around the world is one more extremely regrettable thing about CDA.
Exactly the problem, yeah. It sets a bad precedent at the wrong time, very much the wrong time. We were hoping to point to the long tradition of First Amendment theory and practice in the United States, but that road somehow seemed to be blocked at that moment.
Well, it's not over yet. Mr. Rao, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Madan Rao. I'm with the IPS News Agency. I'd just like to add a piece of information and then a question for the panel. One country which has announced it will not censor the net is Malaysia, interestingly enough. I spoke at Malaysia's first internet conference a couple of weeks back, and the conference was inaugurated by the Deputy Prime Minister, who said not only will the government actively promote diffusion of the internet in the country, but it will also take a hands-off approach and expect the people to themselves understand what to do with the net. So I thought that was pretty interesting, particularly in the Asian region. My question
But before
is,
you go to your question,
sure.
Could I ask you a question?
Sure.
How do you account for that? What is it that encourages a country like Malaysia or any country to make such a pronouncement?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm not from Malaysia. I'm from India, actually. But my guess is that they see two things. One is it's advantageous to use the net for commerce, business, etc., and it's very good to have a quick diffusion of this technology in the country. And secondly, they do have a relatively freer press as compared to many other countries in the world. So they figured this kind of went hand in hand with more free expression. And there's a big resurgence of nationalism and pride and all that in Malaysia. So they're very much into trying to be at the cutting edge, progressive edge, etc. In fact, as another interesting anecdote, the first head of state to make a live broadcast on the internet was the Malaysian head of state, Mahathir Mohamad. The first conference on the internet between heads of state was again between the Malaysian Prime Minister and the Philippine President, Fidel Ramos. So they're pretty much into this stuff. My question is to Dr. Burkhardt. I came across an interesting series of articles a couple of months back about the French government's displeasure about a certain book which was published on the net but actually banned in France. The book was about former President François Mitterrand's decision to tell the French people that he was not suffering from cancer or something like that, when he actually was. So he should not have run for his second term of office. And this book was scanned and then uploaded onto the net in France, from where it was downloaded by users across the world. So the French government said it was going to propose to the EU ministers of information that at the next meeting, they should form some kind of a law on trans-border data flow, similar to the law of the sea or something like that. I'm wondering if you can give us an update on that and similar other moves by the EU ministers of information. And I was wondering if the other panelists can tell us about similar moves perhaps in forums in which the US is a part, say APEC or NAFTA or Organization of American States. Thank you.
I collect them, yes?
Go ahead, yes.
No, I collect.
Oh, no. Why don't you answer that question? Go ahead.
So I couldn't fool you. I am a bit reluctant to comment on these developments in France. Maybe there are people in the audience who know better. To me, this case seems to be more a case of copyright, and of course, the interesting context in this thing was that the publication had been forbidden at the same time, that is, I think, for intrusion into privacy rights and also misuse of medical privilege. And the interesting thing was that perhaps it was more in the interest of the author that this text would still be distributed. But one should be careful to keep these things apart. Although sometimes, and by history, as we have heard this morning, copyright is very often used as a means to gain control over contents and to avoid the distribution of certain contents. The main difference is that the main impetus of copyright is, of course, to make sure that the gains from particular products go into the right products and in these pockets. And in my view, copyright as it is would have been sufficient an instrument to retaliate if retaliation was to be desired. I also think it has something to do with folklore. If, for instance, this particular person who put the text on the internet would have used traditional means of a leaflet, printing it in his cellar and then going out on the streets and handing it out, would have given the whole thing the touch of the French Revolution, and then perhaps French authorities would have more eagerly been prepared to digest what is happening there. I think what really frightened them, was the ease and the speed with which this has happened. So I think first of all, try to keep apart copyright and contents control. And with regard to copyright, I very much agree with the speakers of the panel this morning that existing copyright regulations are sufficient to deal with problems of this kind. Thank you.
Kate, Gara?
I don't, in response to APEC and NAFTA, I'm not aware of anything going on there. But you've piqued my interest, and I'm going to look into it more.
Next question.
Thanks. My name is Larry Kolodny, and this question is addressed to the panel. A few months ago, I heard an interesting interview on the radio of a young man who was actually going on a book tour, I guess, who had formerly been a head of the neo-Nazi youth movement in Germany, and he's since seen the light, apparently, and has written a book about his experiences. And one of the things he said in the interview was that a major source of obtaining neo-Nazi propaganda in Germany, where it's illegal, is from a website located in Nebraska. And my question is, does the German government, or governments generally who have this problem internally, do they have any legitimate interest and or right under international law to try to prevent the injection of Nazi materials into the country? Thank you.
Who wants to take that one first?
He was asking whether or not the German government under international law can try and prevent people in Germany from getting neo-Nazi propaganda on the website in Nebraska.
Well, certainly not under international law, but under German law, let us say, with regard to this material, the distribution would constitute a criminal offense if you distribute this further. So the problem is not so much an individual accessing a website and reading this material. The problem starts where, either by when this material is being downloaded and passed on to other people, or there is a question on when services are involved in making these websites accessible, whether these services should then be held responsible for making, whether they are some sort of associate in this distribution process. This is a tricky legal question which has not been answered with regard to this media, neither in the positive nor in the negative. But it is indeed because of, you know, the particular German historical context, the physical possession and distribution and making available of this material to other persons is indeed something that falls under national criminal law.
I had assumed it was illegal, and my question was really a prudential one to the human rights people, which is, is this a good thing, and should Germany try to stop the entry of these materials into the country?
Well, no, I don't think it's a prudential claim.
If I may add this point, I mean, you can, of course, bring, as a European citizen, you can bring this case to the European Court in Strasbourg, which is different from the European Court in Luxembourg. European Court in Strasbourg, this is the European Convention on Human Rights. And there, Article 10 is, so to speak, the First Amendment thing. But it contains a number, let us say, it contains an exemption regulation that more or less says that what is necessary, you know, for a free and democratic state to regulate can be regulated. And in my reading, the leeway, the area of discretion that national legislators have within this framework is indeed fairly broad. So there is an international law instrument to go as an individual against such national law. But it is only of limited reach so far, in my reading.
I might just add that the question of the protection of that kind of speech under the international law protection for freedom of expression is it's much more tenuous under international law than it would be under the First Amendment. And Anna Guerra, I think, might know more about the actual law on this, but just on a kind of from a personal perspective, I've always been very strongly committed to the First Amendment position in this country, and thought that there's basically, I see no real issue about that hate speech should be protected in this country. But I was in Russia with a group of German human rights activists, and they made, I thought, a very strong case that historically Germany is in a different position. And I ended up feeling that I wasn't in a position to judge whether or not there was some kind of international free speech standard that I would say definitely meant that Germany should allow Nazi propaganda in the way that I think it should be allowed in Skokie, Illinois. And, you know, I think it's a hard question, personally.
Well, I'm on record as opposing these German laws and got attacked by Abe Rosenthal in the New York Times for my pains in doing so. But I don't want to convert this all into a general hate speech discussion, which is what I think it would become. I mean, I don't happen to see the cyberspace wrinkle on this as being particularly critical. I think the cost, and we've tried to show this at Human Rights Watch in a paper that we did about the use of hate speech laws around the world, is just too great a cost to bear. The same technology that permits Nazi propaganda to be disseminated permits anti-Nazi propaganda to be disseminated. We've tried to interpret those international standards in a way that's as protective of free speech as possible and to require a close, very close and direct connection between the speech and an act of violence. And I think that no one's saying that a cyberspace communication exempts you from the normal application of the criminal law if you can prove that connection, but I would set that bar very high as it is in this country. But to talk about it more would probably get us into a kind of a general free speech discussion, which I'm happy to have, but I don't know if you are. So.
My name is Sean Dolan. I work for a company that does library automation software and we sell it in the various list of countries that you've mentioned. And they've always lectured me quite frequently when I mention that I don't think certain things are a good idea, but they oftentimes they mention that they really want to locally control their own destiny, I mean their own language. They want the system to use their own language, their own culture, and they want to do their own content selection. They really don't like this idea of outsiders selecting the content for them. So, I mean, where is the old human rights issue of meddling in internal affairs of a country come into this when you can meddle from Skokie, Illinois?
Well, that issue is traditionally framed in terms of one government putting pressure on another country about its human rights issues, which I think is perfectly appropriate. It's not usually framed in terms of communication between individuals in the world about political issues. And I think it's very important to distinguish between the Nazi skinheads in Illinois communicating with the skinheads in Germany and the positions of governments. I mean, and that basically what the Internet's about is protecting those person-to-person communications. But
can I just use this as an opportunity to say one brief thing that I meant to say before that is somewhat related to your question, and that is how human rights groups are using the Internet, and it's a very, very important development. I mean, Human Rights Watch is a plaintiff in the lawsuit against the Communications Decency Act, and the reason we are is because we came to feel that very strongly, not only a principled opposition on free speech grounds to the provisions of the Act, but that it potentially affected us in a very negative way in the larger human rights movement. In the last couple of years, we started to get information and distribute information through a Gopher site and ultimately a website and email communications with our counterparts around the world. We have material going back and forth electronically that has to do with the rape of women in conflict in Nigeria and in Bosnia, Peru, the trafficking of young girls and women into Thailand from Burma, very graphic descriptions of sexual abuse and violence that may very well, very arguably, run afoul of a vague and overbroad indecency standard. And so I want to just say that I think that the human rights movement is coming to realize that this is not some kind of, we don't see this as some exotic, you know, right to pornography issue. It's one that we feel very personally, and that our information is in danger by this kind of standard. So your question had the word human rights in it, so I thought I could use that opportunity.
Next question. We're going to have time for just one more question, I'm sorry to say. Go ahead.
Well, then I'll try to make it good. This is Richard Threadgill, and my question is for our human rights friends on the panel. In America, obscenity law is as hate speech law is in Germany, I think. It's a very close analogy. We who feel that free speech is strongly important still get sort of queasy when you start talking about obscenity for very many minutes in a row in many parts of the country. How has the human rights community avoided becoming fractionated and ineffectual in the face of, well, you know, pornography might be exploitation of women and this really is about pornography sorts of attacks and that sort of division from within? Because I think fundamentally it's very easy for us who espouse a very tolerant and broad view of the world to be divided in that way.
I'm not
what should I do?
I'm not queasy about it. As I mentioned, I think that you know, we believe institutionally that we have a stake in interpreting speech as broadly as possible. As a practical matter, Human Rights Watch, just to take us, I can't speak for the other human rights organizations, although I know that Amnesty International doesn't even really deal that much in free expression issues to begin with, so really I don't think it would apply to them. We have to some extent skirted that issue, although we have tried to report from time to time on free expression problems in other countries that we saw, that are about essentially about the regulation of pornography, and that we did a report on the Canadian Butler decision, for instance, and the way that it's been used against gay bookstores and lesbian and gay communications. And so I wouldn't so much say that we're skirting the issue. I would say that there's a certain amount of triage in human rights work and choices to be made, and we haven't tended partly because of the very far from universal consensus among in human rights law and among human rights organizations on this issue, and partly because of the question of allocation of resources and having to deal with a number of other things that hasn't been very high on our agenda.
Could I ask Kate and Herbert if you have any closing thoughts? Go ahead. You've got a minute or two. You don't have to have closing thoughts.
Well, I guess I just want to echo Gara's call that people get involved and just say, in a way, to me, the Internet is a tool for the work that we've been doing, and that when I first went to Russia, I met people who had literally gone to jail in Siberia for 7 years kind of for the sake of the First Amendment. And the First Amendment was, it was that important to them. They knew about the First Amendment. They passed out leaflets opposing the Hungarian invasion by the Soviets in 1956 and ended up spending 7 years in Siberia for doing that. And that the U.S. plays, and the First Amendment in particular, plays an extraordinary role around the world. And that the work that all of you do to kind of protect it in this country has that effect and is extremely important for the whole world, I think, in the way that Gara talked about.
I've started with a quotation, and I would like to end with a quotation. It says, a healthy democracy at home made accessible around the world through modern communications can foster the enlargement of the peaceful community of democracies, which is ultimately the best guarantee of a secure, free, and prosperous world. Joseph S. Nye, William A. Owens, in Foreign Affairs, March-April 1996, in the Information Edge.
On that note, and in the spirit of getting involved and staying involved, I'll make two announcements. There is a group that has been in formation for some time, the Internet Law Task Force, which is attempting to address these issues on a global scale. Anyone who's interested in participating in this effort ought to look at the ILTF website, which is at www.discovery.org/iltf.html. You can also join the ILTF listserv.
Write that down.
Sorry?
I didn't quite get that down.
Anyone can come find me or Chuck Morrison afterwards to get this information. You can also join the ILTF listserv, which is ILTF@eclipse.oSC.edu. And finally, CDT, together with Human Rights Watch and the Center for National Security Studies, working with the Soros Foundation, is going to be launching this year something called the World Internet Freedom Project, which will be looking at these issues. And we're looking forward to working with all of you on this question, on these set of questions. And thank you very much for staying here on a Friday afternoon. On this note, Andy Grosso is walking into the hall. I believe we're going to have the follow-up to the crypto moot court discussion. And I will let Bob Pryor tell us what's happening. So please join me in thanking the panel. Very much.
Thank you. We have a couple of brief announcements. The first, Andy Grosso and Professor Nesson are going to be reading the results of the moot court from yesterday. Some housekeeping details for this evening. We're having the reception at the New England Aquarium. Buses are going to be leaving from right outside the main door of the hotel where you came in. They'll be leaving. The first is at about 5:45, and the buses will be cycling through about 6:15 or so, 6:30. Please join us at the aquarium. The presentation of the EFF Pioneer Awards will be at about 7:30. The last bus will be leaving the aquarium at 9, so kind of watch your clocks about then. Move away from the tanks and toward the buses at about 9 o'clock. The Pioneer Awards, by the way, are going to be right near the penguins. It should be easy to spot. Finally, there will be a whole series of BOFs this evening, including one I've been asked to announce, which will be sponsored by Kent Walker, discussing ideas for next year's CFP, CFP 97, which will be held back in the Bay Area. If anyone cannot attend the BOF but would like information about CFP 97, here's yet another email address for you to write down, cfp97@cfp.org. Apparently we've achieved org status. And so I guess I'll turn the session over to Andy Grosso. Thank you.
Thank you very much. What we're going to do is this. Both Judith McMorrow and Charles Nesson will read the decisions that they have written. Maureen O'Rourke was also involved in those decisions. She is unable to be here. We are not going to distribute them today. We will distribute them tomorrow morning. However, if somebody will not be here tomorrow morning or needs a decision this evening for a special reason, I will hand out those decisions to those people. You're going to have to get online. The reason for that is we have the buses waiting to take people to the aquarium, and we don't want to cause problems with that. And at that point, I would ask if our judges could approach the front and all rise.
In the case of Woodbury against United States of America, petitioner was convicted of unauthorized use of encrypted documents in violation of the Cryptography Control Act of 1995. The United States Court of Appeals for the 13th Circuit affirmed his conviction and upheld the constitutionality of the act, and we reverse. I have to break it to you, however, that I have grave doubts whether a real bench would reach the result that we're going to reach. Assuming that everyone knows the facts, we proceed as follows. As stated in the CCA, Congress has a legitimate and compelling interest in effective law enforcement, at least to the extent that it intersects with an enumerated power. That interest, however, does not justify all means of law enforcement. The government not only must exercise its power pursuant to one of the enumerated powers granted by the Constitution, but also must comply with the limitations of granted power in the Constitution as well. The concept of privacy is an important constitutional value that is implicated in many specific constitutional provisions. For purposes of Fourth Amendment analysis, a search begins when the government first interferes with an individual's legitimate expectation of privacy. The First Amendment protects from government intrusion on speech, which includes a recognition of the importance of private activity within the confines of one's home. The Ninth Amendment, although not the express basis of a constitutional right to privacy, implicates the values behind the notion of privacy when it states the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. The traditional jurisprudence of the First and Fourth Amendments does not fit squarely, however, into the challenges posed by encryption, and for this we cite Professor Fromkin. In this case, we need not rely on the specific jurisprudence of the First and Fourth Amendment because this case is better grounded directly in the underlying value at issue. The application of traditional doctrines to new technology is not unfamiliar, and we've refined constitutional doctrines to meet changing conditions. In rare circumstances, we have recognized a constitutionally protected zone of privacy. The zone of privacy has implicated at least three different kinds of interests, and the one at issue here is the right to be left alone. Unlike burglary tools and possession of nuclear weapons, encryption codes are devices that individuals may seek to use to protect proprietary information, personal information, confidential attorney-client communication, or just a gossip. Individuals may seek encryption to prevent a third party from accessing personal data from the Internet. Instances of high-profile hackers have been well publicized. Such private hackers may proceed merely for the thrill of breaking into someone else's computer or possibly to seek information from groups or causes with which the hacker disagrees. Consequently, we begin with the premise that encryption is not a device designed for the primary purpose of aiding individuals in unlawful activities. That encryption codes may incidentally be used by individuals seeking to commit crimes does not make their use inherently suspect, nor, as the government implies, does the desire not to register with the government flow only from those who wish to hide unlawful activity. Never before has this court faced a statute that compelled a universal requirement that a person carry on communication in a manner that would facilitate the government's ability to overhear that conversation if the government otherwise had a lawful warrant. The use of metaphors and analogies in this context is necessarily incomplete, but nonetheless helpful. Encryption is better analogized to the concept of a private walk on the beach, thanks for whoever asked that question, or a private conversation behind closed doors. While the government might legitimately impose time, place, and manner restrictions on such conversations, for example, by prohibiting walks on public beaches from midnight to 6 a.m., the government could not require individuals to disclose their intent to hold such private conversations. Undoubtedly, the zone of privacy is not unlimited. We've recognized many instances in which a government's interest outweighs a reasonable expectation of privacy. The need for a closer inquiry in this case is triggered by two factors. First, as noted above, this statute implicates important privacy interests by compelling all users of complex encryption codes to disclose the key to the government. Second, the statute reaches into the privacy of an individual's home. In such circumstances, the statute will be valid only if the government demonstrates that it has crafted a statute that is narrowly tailored to minimize the invasion of protected interests and that it has chosen the least restrictive means available to achieve its interests. The government has not sustained its burden in this case. We then go on to explain why it isn't narrowly tailored and why they have not demonstrated that it's the least restrictive means, in particular, that they have not put in guaranteed appropriate security measures. Our final two points. As we recognized in Whalen, we are not unaware of the threat to private privacy implicit in the accumulation of vast amounts of personal information in computerized data banks or other massive government files. The concomitant duty to proceed with measured caution and to avoid unwarranted disclosures has not been met here. This duty has its roots in the Constitution, a document intended not only to grant government power, but to limit it as well. We do not suggest there is an absolute right of privacy to use one's computer in any manner one wishes, nor do we hold that the government could never regulate encryption codes. We hold simply that under the statute at issue here, the government has not fulfilled its burden. Reversed. This is the opinion of Maureen O'Rourke and myself. We have a concurrence.
Yes, I concur, and that makes the judgment unanimous by this court, on grounds that seem to me to be more fundamental. I believe that the CCA violates other constitutional, it so fundamentally upsets the notion of a government of limited powers and a citizenry retaining rights that it must be invalidated under the Ninth Amendment. At bottom, this is a case not about whether the government with a valid warrant may make intrusions into the individual's private sphere. There's no doubt that the government can do that. The question is not whether there's an absolute right to privacy or a right to absolute privacy. Instead, we must ask whether there is a right to seek privacy by otherwise legal means, which may or may not be successful depending upon the government's capabilities. More precisely, the question is whether the national government has legislative power to prohibit the people of the nation from communicating in secrecy, secure against government intrusion. That question is as much about what we mean by a government of limited powers as it is about the autonomy of the individual. Indeed, a right to privacy is merely the name we give to the complementary principle of a government of limited powers. I find the constitutional infirmity in the CCA, both because of its shockingly totalitarian view of government power and its impoverished conception of individual liberty. The government, I believe, is simply wrong in asserting that the CCA does nothing more than enshrine the status quo. This argument treats the ability to wiretap as a government entitlement. Yet this ability developed in a natural way, adjunct to the development of telephone technology. The government's position seems to rest on the faulty premise that having obtained an ability to wiretap, it is now entitled to dictate the development of new technologies in order to preserve its surveillance ability. This is an effort to derive a constitutional power not from the Constitution, but from the existence and particular attributes of a mid-20th century technology. The government has no constitutional right to effective surveillance. Indeed, the Constitution grants rights to people, only powers to government. As a purely factual matter, the CCA does more than protect an existing ability to wiretap. Pre-CCA individuals were privileged to arrange their affairs such that if the government did legally search, a find could be difficult. The CCA changes the status quo by imposing a disability where a privilege formerly existed. The government's position has strange and necessarily broad implications. Ultimately, the government must defend the proposition that it has the power to illegalize attempts by individuals to live and communicate in privacy. If the government is permitted to require key escrow in order to enable it to break people's use of codes, why not prohibitions of soundproof rooms to facilitate government bugging, prohibition of strong locks to facilitate government entry, or prohibition of thick or opaque walls to facilitate government thermal imaging? Indeed, it's not clear that the government's position is limited to outlawing high-tech modes of ensuring privacy. If high-tech means of frustrating effective surveillance of communications can be legislatively barred, why not running showers, why not whispers, why not open spaces? Why not secrecy in whatever form? Clearly, the implications of the government's position are unacceptable in our constitutional system. The government asserts that without a statute like the CCA, the government would not be able to watch, infiltrate, and stop some criminal and terrorist organizations. But this supposed justification has no limits. Many different kinds of information would be useful in such efforts, including that obtained from passbooks and locator bracelets. Surely knowing people's location at any given time would be enormously useful in thwarting terrorism and crime. As technology advances, the physical burdens of such systems may all but fade away. Yet the idea that the citizenry might therefore be required to facilitate the government's use of such tracking technologies would be undiminished in its distortion of the constitutional balance between citizen and government. Much has been made of the escrowed keys secrecy, unless a warrant is obtained, as if the requirement of a warrant is a general savior for the government encroachments. But Woodbury is correct in pointing out that the anomalous nature of making a warrant a general safety valve, we require a warrant as a procedural constraint against abuse of abilities the government has acquired through technological advance. That is not the same thing as saying that a warrant requirement makes governmentally imposed disabilities benign. The warrant requirement reflects a necessary limit on what the government has acquired the ability to do, not a constitutional excuse to disable citizens from doing anything else. Indeed, I find it deeply ironic that the government essentially bases its power to criminalize cryptography on its own limitations against cryptography. But the Bill of Rights is premised on a suspicion of a too powerful, too invasive government, the same suspicion that drives some citizens to encrypt their information. Even without the Bill of Rights, the concept of limited power puts the onus on the government to justify the power it asserts, something that has not been done to my satisfaction. Although the government has noted that computer networks constitute a means of interstate commerce within the meaning of Lopez, I think the true nature of the power asserted demands more. Again, the question is not merely the power to regulate commercial channels, but the power to prevent citizens from seeking privacy. The government reads the Constitution backwards when it argues that a right of cryptography, or privacy for that matter, not being specifically stated, must not exist. The Ninth Amendment is explicit. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. I confess that the negative logical structure of the Ninth Amendment should not be twisted into a constitutional inkblot for whatever we may imagine. We should be cautious in too quickly finding rights. Indeed, we have only very seldom based our decisions on the Ninth Amendment. But caution must not be paralysis. To make the Ninth Amendment an empty set would be a constitutional tragedy and a profound misfeasance of our duty to uphold the constitutional order against novel threats. If the Ninth Amendment has any meaning, it means that the unenumerated rights may exist. That unenumerated rights may exist. Where they exist, I believe it is our moral and constitutional duty to ask if they do exist. For the reasons I've stated, I believe that the Ninth Amendment includes the right of individuals to seek privacy in ways that are not illegal by virtue of some government interest unrelated to limitations on privacy. That is, government may illegalize conduct for reasons unrelated to privacy seeking, but I see no way to read the CCA as anything but a broad prohibition against individuals seeking privacy. Allegiance to our constitutional heritage requires that we see this statute for what it is, an assertion of nearly totalitarian powers. Our debt to the present and our hope for the future require that we invalidate it. Thank you.
I'd like to take a moment to thank the shadow panel. I want you to understand the amount of effort it took to write those opinions on very short notice. Normally, judges would have a considerable amount of time in order to dwell on these matters and write opinions. We do not have time for questions and answers, at least, and not formally. Perhaps if the judges would like to stay, we could have some questions and answers that way. Other than that, the session is ended. For those people who do want a decision now and need a decision now, I will hand them out one by one. The others will be available tomorrow. Thank you.